Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's Friday. It must be brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, the independent senator from Vermont, whose website, sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, just a second here, by the way, for the rest of the show, our second hour, our economics guru, Dr. Ravi Bhatra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, internationally best-selling author, New York Times best-selling author of Greenspan's Fraud, is going to be with us. Al Franken is going to drop by at the bottom of the second hour. Lamar Waldron, my co-author with Ultimate Secret and now Legacy of Secrecy, a book about the assassination of Martin Luther King that is hitting the bookstores today. Lamar will be with me in the third hour, so that's our day for you. Senator Bernie Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Hey, Bernie. The economy is just, we're in free fall, it seems.
We are. I'm just looking on my website right now at the front page of the New York Times. It said, crisis spreads to tech sector as Sun plans to cut workforce. Then in their index, they have big drop in retail sales in October. Then there's an article on consumers retreat. Then Eurozone officially is in recession. Then Freddie Mac posts $25.3 billion loss. Then Wall Street falls a day after rally, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the economy, I think, is the issue, and I think it's important that as a nation we begin to have a conversation on an issue that, in fact, too few people know very much about. And we got to figure out not only how we got into the mess that we got into and where we are today, but most importantly, how we get out of it short term, how we create the kind of jobs and increase income and make sure that people have health care and rebuild our manufacturing base and deal with the people who are unemployed. But more importantly, how we create a foundation in our society so that we don't keep going into these burst bubbles and massive suffering. I mean, you know, it's a funny thing. You know, in Washington, you hear about a billion here and a trillion there. And yesterday, my son was telling me about a young man who I know, I've known for many years. Kid, young man, three kids, walked into his office at a big company. Was told that he was fired after 10 years of work there, and escorted out. With three young kids, and that's happening all over America. Tremendous anxiety. People walking into their jobs today and wondering if those jobs will be there tomorrow. And meanwhile, all of this thing has happened so quickly. And one of the outrages out there, Tom, that really bothers me is, and I guess it's of course the Bush administration and their incompetence, but it goes deeper than that. It's for years and years and years we were told that the foundation of the economy was solid, the economy is strong, GMP is growing, all that stuff. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, you look at, we're told that if we don't move very aggressively, there's going to be an entire international financial meltdown. Well, how does that happen? What are the causes of that? And how do we move away from that type of society is, I think, the issues that we need to be talking about.
Yeah. An interesting piece yesterday. I was just looking around for it. I'll have to track the source back for you in a moment. But this guy went back 100 years and found that every time there was a major tax cut, you know, more than about a 30% tax cut on the very, very wealthy, it was followed by an economic boom, followed by a bust. In other words, it created a bubble. It didn't actually create real growth.
Right.
Whereas every time there was an actual tax increase on the wealthy, you had slow and steady growth of the economy over 10, 20, 30-year periods that included strong, steady growth, not only for the rich, but
right.
for the middle class as
well. And I think that is, if you think about it for a minute, that's fairly understandable. But I think what we have seen and what we have to deal with, you know, what we really have got to deal with, and I have to tell you, it is very rarely discussed in Congress, and we need a massive effort to force this issue forward, is, in fact, not only all of this deregulation and not only all of this incredibly reckless speculation, speculation based on greed, which has taken us over the edge. But we have to deal with this issue of unequal distribution of wealth and income. It is not only, to pick up on your point, it is not only a moral outrage that the top one-tenth of 1% earn more income than the bottom 50%, and we have the highest rate of childhood poverty at the same period when we saw a huge increase in billionaires. That's a moral outrage. But from an economic point of view, what you were just saying is that as the rich become so much richer and everybody else becomes poorer, that's bad economics.
Right.
That's bad economics. And that
we saw the top rate on the very wealthiest go from 59% during World War I down to 25% by 1922. It led directly to this bubble of 1928-29, which led to the Great Depression. Reagan cuts taxes. It goes right to the Reagan recession, the crash of 87.
And then we have Alan Greenspan being just shocked. Can you believe it? You give deregulation and tax breaks to the rich, and you let these speculators do anything they wanted. And Alan Greenspan was just, quote-unquote, shocked that in their greed they didn't care about anybody else but themselves, and they brought the planet to the brink of a financial disaster. Just shocked was Alan Greenspan. Couldn't believe that could happen. But, I mean, I think it again raises the fundamental issue, the great political and economic debates that we have. What is the proper role of government in our economic system? And I think if there's a lesson to be learned, what we have got to do is make sure the government plays a much stronger role, not only regulating these large financial institutions, but also making sure that we have a fairer and more equal distribution of wealth in this country, and that we make sure that all of our people, as a right of citizenship, have health care, that people have educational opportunity. There was a piece in the paper a couple of weeks ago, if you can believe it, here in the year 2008, that a higher percentage of our young people are dropping out of high school than was the case a generation ago. We're moving backwards in that area.
And they're doing it because they realize that without a college education, they're not going to make a decent living. And so, and they're having, right, they're struggling with high school. They're not going to make it through college. So they're just saying, screw it.
That's right. I mean, that's certainly
and it's a disaster.
You know, as a nation, we're not educating people to become doctors and engineers and scientists. We're not even doing that. We're bringing.
Well, we have no more manufacturing for people who are just high school graduates.
So, that's right. So, I mean, what we're looking at right now, and of course, the debate of the day is the future of Detroit, which is only another indication of the collapse of manufacturing in America. And the very simple question is, how do you have a strong economy if you're not producing the kinds of goods that people need? Can you really survive if everything you buy comes from China? So there's just a whole lot that has to be dealt with in a more radical way than we have been thinking in the past. And we got to get that conversation going, and then we have to come up with the ideas and the legislation to implement them.
I pointed out on this show that 100% of the cars that General Motors makes in Brazil are flex-fuel cars.
Yep.
The cars that General Motors makes in Europe average 40, 45 miles per mile on fleet average.
Right.
It's not like they don't know how to do this.
And that's why they're manufacturing cars in China as well, I expect, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, last week there was a big announcement of a new partnership between a Chinese company and General Motors. But, yeah, I think it's the Chevy engines are made in China and they're shipped over.
Which are much more fuel efficient and so forth.
Yes. So if there's going to be a bailout of Detroit, and it looks like the Republicans are going to filibuster this thing if it comes forward in any case, and 3 million union jobs may well be lost, but nonetheless, if there's going to be a bailout of Detroit, shouldn't it be accompanied by some sort of really radical restructuring?
Absolutely.
And the philosophy going forward?
You got it. I mean, Detroit has been a disaster. I had the opportunity to speak, there was a meeting in Washington a year ago about, with leaders of Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors, and the UAW was there as well. And these guys did not have much to say. And so the people should be clear in terms of what's going on in Detroit right now and in manufacturing in general. Recently, the big three have been buying out the contracts of older workers who make good wages with good benefits, and they've been hiring new people at about 50% of the wages. So right now, if you're working in a factory in Detroit, you're a new worker. My understanding is you're making something like $12 an hour, which is half of what the older workers were making. They're shutting down plants in America. They're moving to China. and producing to a significant degree the kinds of products that the American people don't want. And as you pointed out, in Europe and elsewhere, they certainly can produce fuel-efficient cars. So if there is to be a bailout, it obviously must be accompanied by a major rethinking of what Detroit has done.
Yeah, although, you know, to their credit, actually, General Motors has, in the last couple of years, they have, you know, one of the most fuel-efficient fleets now of any of the big fleets.
Well, I got to tell you, they have fought us tooth and nail on raising cafe standards. That they have.
That's a tough one. That's a tough one. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, our first hour on Friday, as always. And Bernie will be taking your calls next. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, the lines are already lit up. TomHartmann.com, by the way, for our live free chat room. AirAmerica.com for a free video stream.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Excuse me, 21 minutes past the hour here on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, sanders.senate.gov, by the way, Bernie Sanders' website. He's neither a Republican nor a Democrat, the independent from Vermont. This is our national town hall meeting, Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And in 1938, I think it was, my mother, who is now living in Lansing, Michigan, was the city beauty queen in Charlevoix, Michigan, which is where she grew up. And Matt in Charlevoix, Michigan is on the line. What a blast from the past. That's where my dad is buried, also is in Charlevoix. Matt, thanks for calling. What's up?
Yeah, good morning, Tom. I've actually spoken to you before a couple of times, maybe 1 or 2 years ago.
Oh,
anyway,
great.
Right now the Democrats are, holding their breath to find out if they get a veto-proof majority in the Senate. So I'd like to ask the senator if it's not time to think about altering the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment was brought into force in 1914 as a result of progressive pressure. And it seems to be an outrage to me that we've got a state like California that's got nearly 40 million people, and yet a state like Idaho's got 1.5 million people, and they both have the same number of senators. So I think it's time we really need to start thinking about altering the 17th Amendment.
But all the 17th Amendment did was provide that senators would be elected rather than appointed.
Exactly. But that's right. But it was still a progressive move because before it was up to the legislature of those states. So it was
right.
A move in a more...
Well, I tell you, Matt, you're probably talking to the wrong guy because I come from a small state. And the concern that I have, I'll tell you a very practical concern that I have, just and we saw this in the election that ended a week and a half ago, is that we had an election essentially which focused around 20 states. Everybody knew that Vermont, my state, was going to be voting for Obama. Everybody knew that Utah was going to be voting for McCain big time. The two largest states of the country, California and New York State, were voting for Obama. I'm not sure that they got visited by the presidential candidates at all. So that concerns me. I mean, if you're talking about a presidential election, I think it's important that every vote count, that every American be engaged in the debate, and that did not happen. So how we can create a situation where large swaths of this country are not simply written off is an area that I would like to engage in. But, you know, what we have is based on what the Constitution of the United States put together when the founders created this country. And they said that in the House of Representatives, you will have representation based on population. In the Senate, each state gets 2 votes. And that's something that I can live with.
Yeah, me too, actually. Otherwise, you could have a presidential election where they just campaign in the 20 biggest cities in the United States and ignore everything else.
That's right.
Sean in Vancouver, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, to paraphrase my two favorite authors, Noam Chomsky and Michael Parenti, if the capitalists of today resemble the robber barons of the past, it isn't because they haven't learned, it's because they've learned all too well. They've learned that crime pays. I'm sitting here looking at Kevin Phillips' book, Bad Money, and on page 57, he lists what he calls the U.S. financial mercantilism, bailouts, debt, and the socialization of credit risk. And it's basically, it's a rap sheet of Wall Street. He goes to the SNL bailout, the Mexican peso rescue, long-term capital management. Can't we prove that these guys sought that leverage and sought that deregulation intentionally because they knew they were going to put this stuff onto the American people?
Bernie, if I could add to that, Naomi Klein is out now with an article in The Nation suggesting that the bailout was an extension of the Iraq war thing, which was basically a way to hand another $1 trillion to cronies of the Bush, not necessarily the Bush family, but basically, crony capitalism.
Yeah. What we can say is it is extremely disheartening, to say the least, that after 7 years of telling us how good the economy was, that suddenly they tell us we need a massive bailout and the international financial system collapses without it, and that amazingly enough, a fellow who used to be the head of one of the large financial institutions, Goldman Sachs, is now Secretary of the Treasury, asked permission to dispense $700 billion to his friends on Wall Street without any checks or balances or oversight or transparency, and that some $300 billion of that money has already gone in that direction. I don't think it's quite as simple as the caller makes out. The question is how we got into it, why we allow so few to manipulate so much money without any transparency, why we allow the middle class to decline and the gap between the rich and everybody else to grow, and how we create a system which is far more egalitarian and where the foundations are a hell of a lot stronger than what we currently have. In terms of the bailout, I voted against it for a dozen different reasons. And what we're trying to do now is, as we've talked earlier in this program, is to put money into the hands of working people by rebuilding our infrastructure, by moving away from fossil fuels and into sustainable energy and energy efficiency, create real jobs and improve society, and put money into the hands of working families.
Amen. Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls, 866-303-2270, TomHartmann.com for our live chat room, Sanders.Senate.gov for Bernie's website and his newsletter, AirAmerica.com for a free live video stream.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Ain't no telling where the wind might blow.
Four minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, the place where progressives come to party. It's our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Sanders.Senate.gov is website. On the Tom Hartmann program, TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com. Mark in northern Wisconsin, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders and Tom. Say, my question to you, sir, is why did the federal regulators nix the credit card debt forgiveness for citizens? Was it because the debt of the entire citizens of the United States is almost $900 billion and the bailout was $700 billion? I just wanted to get your feedback on why they wouldn't even consider that.
Credit card debt. I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that it is a very, very serious problem, and the problem is compounded by the outrageous actions of the credit card industry in charging people. And we've discussed this issue on this program a number of times, Tom. I mean, there are listeners out there now paying 25-30% on their credit cards,
right.
And that is just incomprehensible and unacceptable. And I would tell Mark that one of the things that we intend to try to do is bring forth usury legislation, which essentially says that in this country there will be a limit as to the kind of interest rates that can be charged to people. It is just absurd that people are now buying their groceries or filling up their gas tanks with credit cards and are paying 25 or 30% interest rates on that.
Yeah. And I'm reading that the credit card industry might be the next one to be in big trouble the way that the mortgage industry is right now. You know, in places like the Financial Times, there was a piece in the front page today about how because Paulson has changed the focus of his bailout, that now the LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, the rate at the banks loan to each other, has gone up. It went up 2 basis points or 3 basis points yesterday, and they're starting to worry that the credit markets are going to lock back up again. It's like this guy is just flailing. But anyway,
Well, let me pick up on that one point. Yeah. What some of us hope to do, as you know, the original bailout package of $700 billion, which I voted against, had a provision in it that before the last $350 billion could be spent, the Congress had to vote no on it. We want to change that, and we want to give the Congress a more direct ability basically to say yes on it, that you're not going to spend that $350 billion, especially while Bush is president. That is an enormous amount of money. I think there is great discontent, to say the least, about how the first $300 billion has been spent. We don't want to see that money go down a rat hole. I'd rather see that money being used for a significant stimulus package to put people to work. So that's an area that we are going to start paying some attention to.
Pat in Oklahoma City, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Pat.
Considering the election of Barack Obama and all the Democratic seats that have been realized in the House and the Senate, is it finally time that the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment for Women, can be passed? Thank you. I'll listen off air.
This is something that Ted Kennedy announced or submitted year after year after year, starting in the 1980s.
Well, it's something that I strongly support as well, and I hope that we can get to it. I would tell Pat it's probably not going to be at the top of the agenda. I think what we're dealing with most significantly right now is the economy, is bringing the troops home from Iraq, is trying to figure out how we as quickly as possible can provide health care to all of our people, how we make sure that our kids get the education they need and can be able to afford college, how we deal with the national debt. But obviously, I think almost every sensible person in this country believes that we've got to protect the rights of women, and we need an ERA.
Marie in Western Slopes, Colorado, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Wow, this is great. Thank you. Bernie, I have admired you for years, and this is a real honor to get to speak to you.
Thank you very much.
I had just one real quick question. And I thought you might have a different take on this as an independent. Do you believe that the Bush administration will ever be held accountable for what they've done? We can talk the economy, we can talk military, we can talk about the hundreds of thousands of people who've lost their lives directly because of the policies. These folks, will anyone ever be held accountable?
Well, Marie, I certainly hope so. And here's what I think on that. You're right. I think history will record this administration as certainly the worst in the modern history of America, and maybe historians will tell us that they're the worst administration in the history of our country. And the damage that they've done, as you've just indicated, whether it's foreign policy, whether it's the economy, whether it's the environment, global warming, whether it's civil liberties, it's just unbelievable. I was just in Europe. I was in England the other day, and I can't tell you how many people came up to me from all political perspectives saying, welcome back into the international community. We're so excited for what the American people did. I think we do have to take a look at what Bush did. I think it cannot be the immediate focus of all of our attention. That is exactly what the American people don't want. They want us, and the reason that Obama was elected, they want us to address the severe crises that we face. And the last thing they want is us to be, you know, just going over Bush, Bush, Bush. But on the other hand, if we are going to make sure that no president, no future president, does the things that he does in terms of using 9/11 to get us into a war, into attacking civil liberties? How did he go about politicizing the U.S. Attorney's office? What has, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot to be studied and a lot to be held accountable. So the ambivalence that I have is we don't want to spend, you know, the first 2 years of the Obama administration going over Bush. That's the last thing we need. On the other hand, it is important that we know what he did, and in fact, we hold people accountable.
Amen. Cheryl in San Jose, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hey, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much for your program, Tom, and thank you, Senator Sanders, for your progressive leadership in the Senate.
Thank you.
My understanding is that Toyota started a new plant in Canada rather than the U.S. because of national health care insurance there. And also it's my understanding that approximately $1,000 of the cost of each car that's produced in the U.S. goes to health care coverage for auto workers. And I was wondering, instead of a bailout per se, would it make more sense for us to give health care to auto workers, to roll out a national health care program, make it our pilot for the auto workers to help them out?
Put all the auto workers on Medicare, for example.
Yeah, exactly, Tom. Thank you.
Well, actually, there has been, I think that... That idea in a slightly different form has been raised. But I think the more important point that the caller is making, and she's right about Toyota going to Canada, and she's certainly right that not only the automobile industry, but every employer in this country is spending a huge amount of money for health care. And the bottom line is that we are spending twice as much for health care per person as any other nation on earth, with 47 million uninsured, more underinsured, and our health care priorities being absolutely backwards. We're doing a really bad job in primary care, and we're educating doctors who make huge sums of money doing specialty care. So I think what the caller is really suggesting is that we need a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people, high-quality care, freedom of choice of doctors and hospitals, and study after study shows us that we can do it. Our problem is not that we're not spending enough money. Our problem is that our priorities are distorted by the insurance companies and the drug companies, who take a huge chunk of every health care dollar for their own profiteering, and in the process distort our health care priorities, taking us away from prevention, for example, and primary care, and putting money into other areas that are less productive. So I would hope that as soon as possible, when President Obama comes into office, we can begin that discussion and move aggressively to provide health care to every man, woman, and child as a right of citizenship. I don't think it costs more money. I think it means taking insurance companies out of the action, and putting our healthcare doctors dollars into doctors, nurses, and medicine rather than into profiteering.
Right, Dave in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. Bernie, Toyota has $250 billion on hand, no bailout anticipated. GM has $2 billion on hand, bailout anticipated. Southwest Airlines flying high. Is there a CEO pay package in there somewhere we could learn from?
Well, that's a good point. I think certainly one of the areas where people in this country are very, very bitter, and of course it was we've been focusing attention on the financial industry, the financial services industry, is people in that industry in some cases literally making billions of dollars, and many, many hundreds of millions of dollars, manipulating money. We have a situation in America now where CEOs of large corporations make over 300 times what their workers make. And this, obviously, as we try to bring forth an egalitarian-type society, is something that we've got to address.
Yeah, my personal solution for that is roll back the Reagan tax cuts. A conversation for another time. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us, sanders.senate.gov. Check out his website. Tom Hartman here with you on the Tom Hartman radio program on Air America, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com. We'll be right back.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman program at HartmanRadio.com.
Back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. 9 to noon Pacific time, noon to 3 Eastern time. Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, our Brunch with Bernie hour. And Bernie, Mike in Decatur, Illinois is on the line with you.
Yes, Mr. Sanders, when you say that the automakers are getting that kind of mileage overseas, but they're not doing it here, how come you're not saying that they don't have to meet the same strict EPA standards and CAFE rules?
Well, that's right. And some of us, Mike, are fighting against tremendous resistance from Detroit to raise those standards substantially. We went from 25 to 35 last year, miles per gallon, over a period of time, which is clearly not enough. But I got to tell you, to do that, we had to take Detroit kicking and screaming in that direction. What we do need to do is to raise standards. I think it makes sense for a dozen different reasons, including our effort to try to reverse greenhouse gas emissions. We have the potential right now, by the way, in my view, to sell a hell of a lot of cars if we're producing plug-in hybrids. We get those on the market. We got electric cars on the market. We got generally internal combustion cars that are more efficient on the market. What we're going to see in the European Union now, I think, is an increase in their standards and putting pressure on manufacturers in Europe to provide cars that are far more efficient than is currently the case, and that's what we've got to do here as well.
Daria in Scottsdale, Arizona, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Bernie. I was wondering if you'd heard about there's a House Resolution 1509, known as the Executive Branch Accountability Act of 2008, that's been introduced by Tammy Baldwin. I was wondering if you'd heard about that and know anything about it.
I'm sorry, I don't. Tammy Baldwin is a wonderful member of Congress, but I'm not familiar with that legislation.
David in Federal Way, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, excuse me. I wanted to inquire some research. Back between 95 and 99, I discovered that a lot of the big oil companies knocked off all the little guys and monopolated everything and shut down many refineries. I was just wondering if there's any legislation that can be done to get these little guys back their piece of the pie, so to speak.
Well, David, I think you've raised a very important question, not only with regard to the oil industry, where we're seeing much greater concentration of ownership in that issue, in that area, but for society as a whole. It seems to me, when we look at financial services, when you look at oil, when you look at many, many other industries, that in our country we have allowed giant corporation after giant corporation to dominate industry after industry after industry. And that is a very bad thing, in my view, for our economy. Right now, when you look at financial services, you're looking at a tremendous increase of concentration of ownership for companies like the Bank of America, Citigroup, Morgan Chase. And if we don't get a handle on this issue of too big to fail and so few controlling so much, you're going to keep repeating exactly where we are right now. So this whole business of the need to do, in fact, what Teddy Roosevelt did in the early part of the 20th century, of start breaking up these behemoths and providing real competition, is something that I think Congress has got to look at.
Indeed. Mira in Chico, California. You're on the air with Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders. Mira?
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I am curious to know if there's any movement going on to dismantle the 1913 Federal Reserve Act.
Well, I
would not be telling you the truth if I were to tell you that there's a lot of movement in that direction. But I think it's an area that needs examination. You have essentially an entity that is functioning far removed from congressional control or oversight, acting independently. And I think the American people would like to see them brought a little bit into political oversight. So.
Indeed. Or my advocacy, what I'm advocating is simply having us buy the Fed and put it under the Treasury Department, buy it from the bankers.
Tom, before we go any further, what I would like to do is just because Congress is going to be reconvening next week for a lame duck session, I want to just touch on a few things that people might expect and see happening. The big debate right now is whether or not there will be a stimulus package or not. Bush appears to be unsympathetic to it. Some of us think that it is absolutely imperative that we move as quickly as possible and that we can create a whole lot of good jobs, stimulate the economy by putting money, large sums of money into infrastructure, dealing with our crumbling bridges and roads. Some of us think that we can also create millions of jobs over a period of years as we move away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And when you do that, you're not only creating jobs and energy independence, you're dealing with greenhouse gas emissions. The automobile industry and the fate of the automobile industry, do they get a bailout? What kind of bailout? How is it structured? Is also something that we'll be seeing next week. We don't know how long the session will be next week, maybe a few days, maybe a week. And then we're going to break until the new year and the new Congress. But I would hope that during this period, the American people stand very tall and build on the incredible grassroots activity and involvement of the Obama campaign. We are not, definitely not, going to move this country in a progressive direction unless millions and millions and millions of people are prepared to stand up to very powerful special interest in Washington. Earlier today, we talked about national health care. Well, you're not going to get a national health care system unless you're ready to stand up to the insurance companies and the drug companies. You want to bring reform to Wall Street, it ain't going to happen unless millions of people speak out against that concentration of ownership, the secrecy which is going on in a shadow economy. A lot of work to be done, and the only way we do it is if we go forward together.
Amen. Amen. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. He's got a great newsletter there. Get over there and check it out. Subscribe to it. Bernie, thanks so much for being with
Good
us.
Good to be with you, Tom. Take
always,
care.
Always great talking with you. Next week, I'll be on the Air America Cruise, so I'll see you a week from Friday. Coming up next, Dr. Ravi Batra. What's coming up with the economy?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our second hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our economics guru, Dr. Ravi Batra, the professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, internationally known, internationally best-selling, New York Times best-selling author of Greenspan's Fraud, a book you really have to read to understand what went on in the 80s and 90s and really up till today, and the new golden age, the coming revolution against political corruption and economic chaos, which, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, predicted the election of Barack Obama, Dr. Batra?
That's right. I finished the book by the end of 2006, and I predicted that a minority president would be the next one, and also he would be a man of great courage, and he would simply unseat the establishment, and that's exactly what he has done.
You have an uncanny record of predicting these things, sometimes down to the month. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, R-A-V-I-B-A-T-R-A, RaviBatra.com is his website. Ravi, I got an email from a friend of mine in Vermont who keeps very close track of all this, investment stuff and whatnot. And over the last decade and a half or so, I've made a fair amount of money just following his investment advice. I mean, he's just a friend, but he reads all the newsletters and he's really into it. And I'm not talking about day trading things. I mean, I basically tend to buy something and sit on it for 3 years and then make a change kind of thing.
Okay.
And back, you know, about 5 years ago, he said, you know, sell everything and buy into gold funds and oil funds. And boy, did we do well as a result of that. Anyhow, he just sent me an email, and I'd like to share. It's only a couple sentences long. I'd like to share it with you and get your thoughts on it. He says, first of all, he starts out quoting Jim Sinclair, who's got a website called jsmineset.com, as in Jim Sinclair Mindset.com, which I read frequently. I think it's a very good one. Pressure is picking up in the demand for the Fed to outline what they have done with the trillions put into play and to disclose what their inventory of, quote, assets, end quote, is. Thank Bloomberg's lawsuit, by the way, for that. It is a very bad time for the Fed to refuse. Cooperation, however, might actually cause a major embarrassment in the dollar and soon. And then my friend Mike says, Tom, verily, verily, I say unto you, we have an Argentine-style dollar crash in our future. All the obligations slash debts slash derivatives being taken on share. One thing in common, one thing in common, they are denominated in U.S. dollars. They politically can't default on the debt, but debauch the dollar and you've destroyed the debt. Oldest trick in macroeconomics, and lots of zeros in the currency. Debt goes away, but the poor and middle class are decimated. Think Weimar and Zimbabwe. Hold gold, buy stock gold, mutual funds, double bottom today, possible end of correction and resumption of uptrend. You know, God bless Mike. What do you think?
Well, I think gold is a good buy right now. And again, this is only my opinion. I don't like to give financial advice. I mean, I'm getting a lot of emails from your audience, by the way. They're very worried, and they want financial advice from me, and I just don't do that.
You're an economist, not a financial advisor.
So even if I were, because there are liabilities involved, you know, and
right.
I could give financial advice, but I don't want to.
Yeah.
But last time on your show, I suggested that if you want to buy gold, buy some gold shares and then sell options on those. Like I suggested, this ABX, which is Barrick Gold. ABX is a symbol for that. Now, that was selling at about $20 last time with an option premium of about $250 or something. It came to about $10 return for 1 month, and I thought that was not a bad buy. Now it has gone up slightly. It's 23 now, and it is still a good way to, still pretty good in terms of historical prices. It was $50 6 months ago. Now it's 23, and the option premium is still about $2.5-$3 for a 2 month option. That's the way I would get into gold because it has gone up sharply.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the big picture here, because that's your specialty. We're talking with Dr. Robbie Batra, professor of economics and internationally best-selling author. Where are we at, Dr. Batra, in this cycle that you described in the new golden age? It seems to me that we're probably within a year of hitting bottom, but there are others who are suggesting that maybe right now is the bottom.
It's not the bottom right now. No, no.
Yeah. There's too many layoffs going on right now that have not yet seeped all the way through the economy.
It has just started. And I know it has started so badly, so it seems like a bottom. It should be a bottom. But and looking at the recessions in recent past, this should be a bottom. But no, it's not a bottom at all. In fact, right now nobody is really in charge. It's a transition time. And watch out for really bad falls in December, and January until Obama takes over. This is a very tricky, precarious time. But the sad part is that it doesn't have to be this bad. We can easily fix it, and I have outlined my reforms in the book. And the reforms are very easy to introduce. Just look at the auto industry, for instance. It's in really bad shape, and they're talking about, I think, about a $50 billion bailout, $25 billion now, and then another $25 billion later when Obama takes over. They're talking about a $50 billion bailout. And first of all, how many of these bailouts can they do?
Right.
Not the amount of borrowing that the U.S. federal government can do is not unlimited. And And there are going to be bad consequences, and one of them could be the crash of the dollar, which you just mentioned.
Yes.
A simple way would be to buy, the government buys up, say, 60% of GM stock. It's selling at less than $3 a share. So it would be about $1 billion, $1.5 billion investment. Sell those shares to the workers of GM at a very cheap rate. Maybe just give them away because the government is willing to spend money anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Sell those shares to the workers of GM. Let them manage their company because we will then have forced out the current management, which is responsible for the horrendous mess to begin with.
Wow. Yeah, sell the shares to the workers and then immediately call a shareholders meeting.
That's right. And then they will elect their own board of directors. They would also select their CEO from their own ranks who knows the nitty-gritty of the auto building. They're not paper pushers like the current CEOs are. They just want to do deals rather than, hey, introduce some new technology, build some efficient models which the public wants to buy. The other Japanese producers and other producers are not doing as poorly as ours.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that ours, you know, they just are not interested in doing what the market wants.
Right. So now, when you look at the Argentine currency crash, you invoked that, my friend Michael did. I've seen the graphs on that, and literally the Argentinians, you know, I don't know what day of the week it was, but like, for example, one Monday night they went to bed thinking everything was fine. Tuesday morning they woke up to news stories and rumors of problems, and by Wednesday, $100 in the bank was worth $15. I mean, it was like a crash that happened within a week.
Well, I don't think that kind of thing can happen to the United States. I can see the dollar falling sharply, but not a total crash like that of Argentina. The reason being, if the dollar falls very sharply, the rest of the world will not be able to sell anything to us, and they don't want to do that. That will kill their economies, too.
So the Japanese and the Chinese will buy dollars to hold the dollar up, as they've been doing.
That's what they've been doing, and still their currencies are rising, so they'll contain the dollar's fall to the best of their abilities. That will prevent the crash.
Now, what do you think about all this speculation that the carry trade is the only thing that has been driving up the value of the dollar? The carry trade being where people go to countries where interest rates are very low and they buy a lot of that currency, they borrow a lot of money in that currency. For example, the dollar right now, our interest rates are, you know, a percent, percent and a half. And then they take that money and they buy bonds in a nation where the interest rates are 6 or 7%. They pay a higher rate of return. At the end of the year, they cash in those bonds and they pay back the dollars and they make a 7% return on their money for doing absolutely nothing. And there's this enormous carry trade out there that used to be denominated in yen and it seems to be shifting to dollars right now. Is this a factor?
That's one of the factors, but that's not the major factor, but it's certainly a factor. Now, but the biggest factor is what people like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, you know, the ones which are being bailed out now, what they did in the past, and now their actions are driving the dollar back.
I'd like to get some more details on that when we come back from the break, and you can stick around and take calls with us.
Yeah, sure.
Can we do 45 minutes today? We've got Al Franken coming on at 45 minutes past the hour, but great. Okay, thank you. Dr. Ravi Batra with us. And we'll be taking your calls for Dr. Batra right after the break. 16 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Show. RAVIBATRA.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman Show. Dr. Ravi Batra with us. RaviBatra.com, his website. He's the author of The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, and Greenspan's Fraud, among other books, and a professor of economics at SMU. Ravi, before we take calls, and we've got the board is totally slammed with calls for you, but before we do that, if you could just unravel some of this stuff for us, the role of the carry trade in that is people basically speculating in currency, moving currencies around, you know, borrowing and then getting interest in currencies, number one. Number two, the idea that there is perhaps as many as $540 trillion in derivatives still out there. Webofdebt.com has all the information on that. I mean, that's according to the Bank of International Settlements.
$540 trillion?
Pardon?
Did you say $540 trillion?
That's right.
God.
Yeah, $540 trillion.
My.
A half a quadrillion.
Of the derivatives, eh?
Yes, and consider the GDP of the entire planet is $62 trillion. And then, you know, on top of this, the fact that Henry Paulson yesterday has announced that he is not going to do what Congress said he had to do. All along, they've done none of the oversight. He hasn't even populated the board that's supposed to provide oversight for how he's passing out money, but he's already passed out $300 billion, and the Fed has already passed out $2 trillion, and they're refusing to tell us where that money went. And but in any case, as a consequence of his saying that he's going to change horses, he's going to start putting that money in other places. Now, the London Interbank Offering Rate, LIBOR, this is from today's Financial Times. The key benchmark lending rate between banks rose yesterday, ending a 23-day decline as traders reacted to the U.S. government's decision to abandon its plan to buy toxic assets. Three-month dollar LIBOR edged up 2 basis points yesterday and was set to continue its ascent today. So what do you think of all this? What does all this mean?
Well, see, first of all, your question was about the rise of the dollar right now.
Yeah.
What has been going on in the past, in 2007 and 2008, early part of this year, Goldman Sachs especially, would come out with a forecast. They would say, okay, oil is going to hit $100 a barrel. Say it's 70, they would say oil is going to hit $100 a barrel over the next 3 to 6 months.
Right.
Then, after they make the forecast, they borrow a lot of money from banks and start buying the oil contracts. In other words, they start speculating in oil. Now that they have created market psychology, they start speculating in oil, and so the oil price starts going up as they do that.
Right. Plus, everybody sees somebody's buying a lot of oil. I better get in on this.
Exactly. So this way, the oil starts going up. Then they also discovered that somehow, whenever the euro went up, oil also went up with it. So in addition to buying oil, they started to buy up euro also. You know, why not raise the price of oil? And then they also found that as euro goes up, gold also rises. So they were buying all these things simultaneously with borrowed money.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the things started to unravel. The U.S. economy is not responding. People are worried, and the recession fears are there. So then oil started to fall. And now you are in a panic board.
Right.
So as oil fell, they started to sell oil contracts, they started to unload euros, started to unload gold, so everything has fallen sharply. So that's why the dollar has made a comeback. That's the main reason, and the carry trade is another reason. But the interesting part is that our government is now giving money to Goldman Sachs to bail it out. This is crazy.
So are you suggesting that Goldman Sachs was the major or one of the major speculators in oil that drove up the price of oil? I mean, the current chairman of the Fed, Paulson, was the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. Robert Rubin, who was chairman of the Treasury Department. The chairman of the Treasury Department under the Clinton administration, Robert Rubin, is a former CEO of Goldman Sachs. The guy in charge of passing out the money, the $700 billion right now, is a 35-year-old employee of Goldman Sachs. Are you suggesting that Goldman Sachs is the spider at the center of this?
Goldman Sachs is the ringleader. They would make these forecasts, and then their actions would bring about a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so that's why oil jumped to $147 per barrel in July, and then that's exactly the reason why it has collapsed, because of all that speculation that they did. But they not only speculated in oil, they also speculated in the euro, in gold, etc. All three of them went up sharply. Now all three have fallen sharply as a result.
Right. So are they going to go back up? Are they going to stay the same? I mean, what's...
I think oil may have one more chance to make a comeback. Mm-hmm. Even though the economists don't predict that right now, next year it could happen. I think Middle East might explode next year. That's from my other cycles that I've explored. From the social cycle tells me that the Middle East could explode next year and then could drive oil back.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like just rough times and rough times. So a good time, I guess, basically to be in cash, I suppose, or maybe in Swiss francs. Dr. Ravi Batra, we'll take your calls right after the. We'll take calls for you, Dr. Batra, right after the break here. Dr. Ravi Batra with us, RAVIBATRA.com is his website. His books, you have to have these books: The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Program where we don't do suck off interviews, we have conversations. We're having one right now with Dr. Ravi Batra, the professor of economics at SMU, internationally best-selling author of Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age. And Dr. Batra, ready to take some calls?
Sure.
Okay, Mike in Seattle, Washington, listening on KPTK Talk 1090, year on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hi, how you doing? Hey, I've been listening to Nouriel Roubini, I believe it is, who's been talking a bunch about going into a deflationary period, and I heard Ravi talk about actually going into an inflationary period. Well, anyway, either way, I'm wondering if he can explain to me his theory on what direction we're heading.
Well, I think either scenario is possible right now, but we could have inflation just as well as slight fall in prices. Prices are not going to fall that much, first of all. And so much money they are creating, all these $2 trillion that Ben Bernanke has already put into various companies. They're creating so much money, supply. I think that has to do inflation at the same time. That will create.
But that shows up a year or so down the road, doesn't it? Typically.
Right. Exactly. Also, I feel that the dollar is whether it's going to crash or not, it certainly will fall, and that itself is inflationary. Mm-hmm. So I think inflation will heat up some, either next year or in 2010. But eventually, it will fall sharply when the economy is really bad. But temporarily, it could heat up.
Yeah. Okay. Joe in Tempe, Arizona. Hey, Joe.
Hey. Yes, I'm a Sarah Palin Republican. I just like to say, if they want to fix this economy, they need to cut taxes, not raise taxes. And this thing you talk about putting the Reagan tax cuts on the shelf, you're crazy. We need to have we don't want to penalize success.
Yeah, Joe, are you old enough to recall the 50s, 60s, and 70s?
I recall the 70s. I recall the 80s. And Ronald Reagan changed everything for the better. And let me tell you, this market is responding to Barack Hussein Obama being elected president. That's why you see the crash.
I see. Okay, this crash apparently just started on Election Day, and this is what all the right wing talk show hosts are talking about right now. Ravi, is they're calling it the Obama recession. This is really not only is it flawed logic and incoherent thinking, but politically toxic. The greatest and most sustained period of real solid growth in the U.S. economy, both for average working people and for rich people, was from the mid-30s through the early 80s, which was a time when the top tax rate was between 71 and 91%.
That's right.
And then once Reagan dropped that tax rate down to 27%, we saw a bubble occur, and then the great crash in 87.
Can I intervene right now?
Pardon?
Could I intervene a bit now?
Yes, please.
Reagan did not cut taxes contrary to all the propaganda. He cut the income tax, which cut taxes for about maybe 50-60% of the people. He raised all other taxes. Every other tax went up. Excise tax, gasoline tax, taxes on cigarette, taxes on Social Security tax, self-employment tax. By the way, the self-employment tax is the biggest killer of small businesses. That tax jumped by 66%.
Yeah, let me tell you about it. I know it well.
So I don't understand. Why do they keep saying that Reagan cut taxes? He cut taxes for a small majority of the public and raised them for everybody else. So I would call it a tax rise. I wouldn't call it a tax cut.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And all right.
After that was tax transformation. Transforming the tax burden from the wealthy to the poor and the middle class. Of course, when you follow this kind of unethical policies, the end result is going to be catastrophic, and that's what we have right now.
Yeah. Rob, in Virginia, Minnesota, you're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hi, I need to be able to take and let you, please keep me online because I need to be able to take and answer this one question. America has to be able to compete in a global economy, and it's one of those things where most of the economies in the world, the individual countries, have national health care. How do you finally get it across to the people in America, the haves and the have-nots as far as health care insurance? If we're trying to be able to compete in a global economy, doesn't health care insurance for people, how can America compete with all of these other global economies when we don't have national health care?
Answer the question, yes. Either we have national health care system or we abandon free trade. And I can easily argue that free trade is creating this current steep recession, could create a depression. I've heard from a lot of people saying that the Smoot-Hawley tariff created the depression of the 1930s, which I don't believe. But now I can tell you that free trade could create the depression. The reason being, why do we have the real problem? We come back to the same old question. Wages are not rising. Productivity is rising fast. Productivity is the main source of supply. Wages are the main source of demand. When supply rises faster than demand, then the only way to maintain supply-demand balance is to create a lot of new debt. That's what we have been doing ever since Reagan in 1980, and now the debt burden is so huge, we can't create debt anymore, and still they want to do the same thing. So the problem is wages are not rising at all while productivity keeps going up. And why are wages not rising? Because of free trade. So free trade is now chiefly responsible for the current recession, and I can predict it here right on your show. As long as we have free trade, we are not going to come out of it.
All right. Another gift from Ronald Reagan. Bad Samaritans, by the way, by Chang, is a brilliant book on that topic. It should be on a bookshelf along with your two books, Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age. Very well said. Thank you. And we have to have a national health insurance policy, as Rob in Minnesota pointed out, simply to compete with other countries, do we not?
I agree, yeah.
Okay, yeah, okay, well said. Rob, thank you very much for the question. Kel in Hallandale, Florida, you're on the air with Ravi Batra.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Batra, I don't think they should bail out the auto industry, but if they do bail out, they should put restrictions such as 50% of all parts of a car should be made here in the United States. That would create jobs overnight. And if Toyota wants to manufacture here in the States, they should do the same to them. Say 50% of the parts have to be made here in the United States. Overnight, you create jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And all these bailouts, they're not creating jobs for anyone. They're just giving the people that had money and threw it away make more money.
Right. Kel, excellent point. Ravi, aren't domestic content laws a very, very big part of the economies of Japan and South Korea, for example?
Well, that's exactly what I was talking about, that we have to, in the end, abandon free trade. And this is right. what the caller is saying, the same thing. But I think we should start the process of economic democracy. Buy up these shares, sell them, or just give them to the workers of GM. They can then fix out how much wage to charge to make an efficient car. How much, what should the salaries be? They can then decide for themselves. They won't even have to lay off people. In fact, when all of them own the company collectively, not all, I mean the entire company, but say 60% of it, then they will not fire anybody else. They would just reduce the working hours, so nobody would be fired.
I just sent your suggestion, in fact, to Senator Bernie Sanders, who was our guest in the last hour, because I thought this is brilliant, and I'm slapping my forehead. You know, why didn't I think of this? This is like, once you think of it, it's like, geez, how obvious. You know, if you could buy 60% of the stock of GM, I Googled this. Bed Bath & Beyond right now has a higher valuation than GM. I mean,
and they can do the same thing for AIG. I mean, they're just wasting money for no reason. For AIG, for everything else that they're bailing out, just do this. Buy up their shares, give them to those shares to the workers. Let's create economic democracy. That will also plug the difference between the real wage and productivity. See, when productivity rises, automatically wages will go up. When workers are managing their own companies.
Right, and then those workers can sell the stock over time
exactly.
if they want as the value goes up. Kevin in Ogden, Utah, we have a minute left here. Kevin.
Real quick, thanks, Tom. And Dr. Batra, I was just curious, you posit that supply is outpacing demand and that productivity is outpacing wages. And in regards to the auto industry, why don't they produce less cars, make them kind of a pre-order item, you know, build less than the demand there is for them? Would that help?
Well, what has been happening is that the GM and auto industry management just did not pay attention to the public needs. They artificially tried to create demand for large cars, SUVs.
With advertising and with rebates and discounts and free gasoline.
And if the people were responding to market demand, they would not be investing so much in all those huge SUVs.
Right.
It would produce efficient and smaller cars, and that's the whole reason. That's why I think the management should be also booted out, and that will happen when you sell shares to the workers.
Yeah, well said. Dr. Ravi Batra, thanks so much for being with us, Ravi. It's great talking with you, as always.
Thanks a lot, Dr.
Al Franken is coming up next. By the way, Dr. Ravi Batra's website, ravibatra.com, ravibatra.com, and get his books, Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age. You need to read these books if you want to be economically literate. Stick around.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Al Franken on the line with us. Al, hey,
hi.
Welcome. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
I understand that you guys have filed a lawsuit in Minnesota. I'm broadcasting from a Clear Channel station here in Portland, and so in the bathroom they play Rush Limbaugh. And I was in there during the break. I was in there during the break a while back, and they're going on and on about, you know, Acorn's got 80,000 phony voters in Minnesota, and why isn't anybody looking into this? I mean, it's bizarre. So what's going on there in Minnesota, Al?
Well, first of all, we were not the first to go to court. They were the first to go to court, but that really doesn't matter. We're just trying to make sure that all the votes get counted. They went to court because they tried to stop 32 absentee ballots, legitimate sealed absentee ballots, from being counted, and they lost. And we're now going to court to make sure that people who absentee ballots that were not counted for one reason or another, and there's legitimate reasons sometimes, often, probably majority of the time, and the vast majority of the time, but that there are people that we're hearing from who voted absentee who are worried that their vote didn't get counted, and in some counties they are will reveal that they put out the ones that didn't get counted, and we're finding people who legitimately wanted to vote and did try to do everything right and didn't get counted. So we want that to happen in every county.
Make sure everybody gets counted. So we're also hearing on the right-wing side a bunch of these phony stories that somebody was driving around with a bunch of ballots. Turns out the ballots were never in anybody's car. They never sat for several days. They were never lost or forgotten. And this is, but you even have Hannity talking about this on television. I mean,
this is the right-wing echo chamber that I've talked about a lot in the books I've written.
Yep.
They were actually in someone's car, but let me explain why. It's because the Star Trek transporter hadn't been invented yet. So these ballots had to go from the central place where people came to cast absentee ballots to the precincts that they were to be counted in. And they were driven by an election worker who was accompanied by three election judges, one from each party, including the Independence Party. And she drove them around to the various precincts, and one of the precincts had closed exactly at, when the polls closed.
Right.
So they weren't there to receive these absentee ballots, these 32 absentee ballots. So she drove them with the three election judges to City Hall, where she and the three election judges agreed on a way to secure them in a locked room. And then she and I'm not sure it's the same three election judges, I want to be precise and accurate, got them again and drove them to the precinct. So they wanted those not to be counted. And then, but beyond that, they started this myth that is perpetrated by, even after it's been shown to be a myth, by Hannity and by Governor Pawlenty of Minnesota, on Hannity's show, on Hannity and Combs. And, I'm sure by Limbaugh, although I haven't been monitoring him. I mean, I just,
this is
what they do to try to cast doubt on the recount. And, so it's, I've written a lot about the sort of the right-wing echo chamber and how it tries to, play
the
refs.
They're trying to delegitimize in advance. Al, we had Jim Martin on yesterday, who is running in a rematch, actually, on December 2nd down in Georgia against Saxby Chambliss. And
right,
his
a runoff,
website,
Yeah,
a runoff, thank you. And his website, martinforsenate.com, is a place where people can actually go and contribute to his effort, because he's got a real campaign going on.
Right.
And he has a very specific call to action in that regard. Is there any sort of call for action? You know, what's your message to our listeners about how they can help make sure that win or lose, that this process is done right and done fair? Or is this the sort of thing where we should just, you're just kind of updating us here and we should just keep, hang on?
No, well, there is a way. I mean, oddly enough, this recount is going to cost in the neighborhood of $3 million. And people say, doesn't the state pay for the recount? Well, they pay for the mechanics of the recount. But we, right now, my campaign office is as full as it's ever been, because we have to put about 1,000 people in the field to monitor these ballots as they're counted at these counting sites all over the state. And so we have a field operation going. We have to pay, the field operation. We aren't paying the volunteers. We're finding houses for them around the state to stay in. We're trying to recruit people from all over the state. And we do have an incredible grassroots organization. But we have to keep the campaign
going. So what's
the
call for action, Al?
The call for action is you can go to alfranken.com/recount, and you can help us. you know, and
people
we
can
also
help out financially. They can help out by hopping on a plane and coming to Minneapolis.
Well, they can help us out financially. They can help us out by volunteering, by coming to Minnesota. And in that case, I'm not sure where you would go, but
yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Recount help. We got it. Recount help at alfranken.com.
Okay.
And so that's, so we need people to come in to be volunteers to, count, or to monitor, the counting.
Right.
We need lawyers, who are volunteering. We need 120 lawyers. Now, I'm not sure how many we have right now. I have a lawyer coming in from, you know, who did my showbiz stuff. He used to be my lawyer.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was in show business, I used to be in that.
When you used
but
to
not anymore. Anyway, so he's coming in, and I have some friends coming in from different parts of the country just to monitor votes. And you know, if you're listening in Minnesota, then you don't have to, you know, then call us up and you can help, and or you can put somebody up. You can put somebody up who is going to be in your area.
That's great. And people can learn all about it over at alfranken.com. Al, thanks so much for being with us and for
Tom, thank you.
Keep up the great work, sir.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, set your TiVo or your DVR or whatever kind of contraption you've got, or maybe just your alarm clock. 11 a.m. on next Friday, a week from today, the Discovery Channel is going to rerun the hour-long special that they did with Lamar Waldron and I on the last book that we wrote together, Ultimate Sacrifice, about the administration and assassination of John F. Kennedy. And VanityFair.com next week is going to be posting an exclusive article about our new book, which is called Legacy of Secrecy. Lamar Waldron with me. The book is by Lamar Waldron with Tom Hartman. Lamar Waldron is with me. Hey, Lamar, congratulations on getting this book together and out and printed. It looks beautiful.
Thank you so much, Tom. And, of course, your listeners should know that you were invaluable in doing all that early research. Man, it's almost been 20 years ago we started doing this. And, you know, we wound up talking to 24 people who worked with John and Robert Kennedy and all those trips to the archives. And, you know, but even now, as people can see in Legacy of Secrecy, just incredible new information continues to come out.
Yeah, and I made a trip to Paris, France, tracking down Michel Mertz. I mean, we were all over the world, literally, you and I, looking for information for these two books. And in this book, in the last book, Ultimate Sacrifice, we nailed down who killed John Kennedy and how and why. In this book really is more about the legacy of the secrecy around the Kennedy assassination and how that led directly, among other things, to the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King.
That's exactly right, because all that secrecy surrounding President Kennedy's murder allowed three of the conspirators, self-confessed conspirators, to later help to murder Dr. Martin Luther King.
The same guys who killed JFK.
Right. Three of the same guys who confessed to killing JFK. And that's one of the big new things in this book, is that one of those people who confessed, Carlos Marcello, the mafia godfather of East Texas and Louisiana. And you remember when we would go to New Orleans, you know, and people were still afraid of him in the late 80s, early 90s, died in 93, while he was in federal prison, 1985. 4 years before he had a debilitating stroke, he made the most incredible confession to a credible FBI informant. I mean, found credible by a federal judge, that just basically laid it out that he had met Oswald, he had set Jack Ruby up in business in Dallas, and Carlos Marcello basically said, blurted out to a very trusted associate who happened to be an FBI informant, that I had, you know, JFK killed. I would do it again. He was a thorn in my side. I wish I could have done it myself. And that helped to trigger this huge FBI program targeting Marcello in prison. They had bug transistor radio, got hundreds of hours of tapes. induced Marcello to commit all these crimes in prison, and then the FBI completely covered it all up. So in the 25th anniversary, when you and I were starting to investigate things around 88, you know, the time of Oliver Stone's movie, nobody knew this till I found the uncensored documents in the National Archives just 2 years ago, and we have all of those in the book for the first time. Flat out confessed, but we also explained why the FBI had to cover so much up, not just in 85, but all that secrecy that they covered up in the weeks after own murder. And not just with Marcello, but with a racist friend of his named Mel Tier from Georgia, who had helped Marcello and Marcello's racist associates kill JFK. Flash ahead, 1967, 1968. Marcello's under a little pressure from the FBI. Mel Tier's under zero pressure because there was a lot of racism in the FBI at the time. And so essentially Mel Tier, Joseph Mel Tier, who was from South Georgia, come up to Atlanta every week, collect thousands of dollars a week from Atlanta's highest paid factory workers. And he was actually using that money for his own gain. He and his Atlanta partners buying up undeveloped mountain land in North Carolina. They were telling people, well, this is to fight civil rights. Most trusted contributors were told this money is going to be used to kill Martin Luther King. After a few years of that, those trusted contributors were like wanting results. So Mel Tier was under enormous pressure from people, some of whom were affiliated with the Klan and such, so you couldn't put these people off, to do something to get rid of King. That's when Mel Tier turned to his old associate from 1963, Carlos Marcello, who essentially, according to FBI files withheld from Congress that we also have in the book for the first time, Marcello essentially brokered the hit on King for right. Joseph Mel Tier and four Atlanta racists. And James Earl Ray was a low-level drug runner, ex-convict on the run, for the Marcello organization. So that's, we have all that in the book and so much more for the first time showing how, you know, it's just one more way that all this government secrecy that we're still plagued with, you know, really came back in that horrible way back in 68. And you know, there's so many echoes of that same kind of racism and the hatred toward Obama, the death threats toward Obama. All these the cross burnings, the KKK murder last week. It's like we've got so much hope right now, you know, with this new president-elect. And yet, unless we can come to terms with this racism and government secrecy from the past, you know, we just never want to be in that position of seeing history repeat itself.
Right. Just as we laid out the Kennedy assassination in this book, Legacy of Secrecy, which is hitting the stands this week. And the Discovery Channel, again, a week from today at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, will be rerunning the hour-long special that NBC produced with you and me, and most of it's you and me, on our last book, Ultimate Sacrifice, which really this is a segue from. And VanityFair.com will be posting an exclusive article about the book next week. We're talking with Lamar Waldron. Legacy of Secrecy is the book. Legacy of Secrecy .com, is it, Lamar?
Yeah, legacyofsecrecy.com has a little information right now, and we'll be posting more in the coming weeks, including the actual files that we're talking about here.
Right. We're breaking this stuff. I mean, stuff that the FBI and the government have literally kept secret for 30, 40 years in some cases. We've got it. We've laid it out. We've been involved in numerous over the years. Everything from lawsuits with the government to going around it's just incredible the work that has gone into this book and the brilliant writing in particular that Lamar put into it. Lamar, editor and publisher magazine, which is the trade magazine for the publishing industry, has an article today in which they're talking about how a busload of Idaho elementary school tots were chanting "Assassinate Obama." In a suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a high school teacher's aide berated a 16-year-old Obama supporter, a biracial supporter, saying that Obama was going to be shot and killed. The Associated Press reporting several cars in Long Island vandalized with anti-Obama messages, including promises to kill him. I mean, it goes on. There's a whole long list of these things. And this is the exact – and this may seem shocking to many Americans – but you and I are old enough to remember, and you lived in Atlanta your entire life. I lived there 13 years, although I tell you, I grew up in Michigan. It was the same. We're old enough to remember when this was how people responded to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. This was how people, many white people in this country, were responding to the civil rights movement, and it created the atmosphere that made it possible for Marcello and company to murder Dr. Martin Luther King. What can we learn from this, Lamar?
Well, you're exactly right. You know, things were actually, you know, worse in the 60s, but in the same vein, and you had big business because, you know, the racist message was an anti-union message. So they loved,
right.
You know, big business would actually help to stir up racism, use it against unions. And you had politicians like George Wallace and Lester Maddox, who were both, you know, crafty men. Wallace lost his first election when he was supported by the NAACP, so he kind of went the other way. Lester Maddox was a savvy restaurateur. They would exploit racism for their own gain, especially in the 60s, the blockbusting, where they would, you know, scare a lot of white residents into fleeing to the suburbs. And this was a very organized, systematic thing. Atlanta was a microcosm of that, was also a ground zero of that. In other words, the same things in the rest of the country were magnified in Atlanta because that was the home of Dr. Martin Luther King, where he preached, where his office was. So just as those people, big business, politicians like Wallace and Maddox and many, many others, used racism as a way to divide people, set them against each other to make money and political power, people are doing that today.
Yeah, I would submit to you, Saxby Chambliss is doing that right now, where he says our people didn't show up in large enough numbers to vote.
Well,
Obama's people did.
And how about the Georgia congressman that was comparing, you know, was saying, you know, comparing Obama to a Marxist and, well, saying he was a Marxist, comparing him to Hitler. And the tragedy is a lot of these people, and you can go back to George Wallace, they may not even be severely racist themselves. They may be, but it's to get political power, to get money.
Right.
And my worry is that a lot of people who may be decent at heart don't realize the forces they're setting loose. And that's what this book is about, is that, you know, unless we can bring this hidden history to light, your listeners, they should contact their congressman, get them to release all these JFK and King files.
This is really important. LegacyOfSecrecy.com, the website. Our Discovery Special, Channel Special, a week from today at 11 a.m. Lamar Waldron with us. Legacy of Secrecy, the book. Thanks, Lamar.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Stephanie, is that Mark Begich on line 10, please? Oh, we don't. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you said we did. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, since we're waiting for Mike. Dave in Detroit, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Mike. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Well, just a fascinating subject when we're speaking of JFK. But I'd like to say, just for historical accuracy, to say that Carlos Marcello assassinated Kennedy, and leave it at that, I think is factually wrong. While he was probably heavily involved, probably financed a lot of it, probably involved in the plans, he was certainly given the go-ahead by the CIA, rogue CIAs, or by somebody in the government. Because if you remember, the CIA was working with mafia guys to kill Castro.
Yeah, this is where the whole thing started. In fact, it goes back to the Bay of Pigs investigation. And Dave, I refer you to our book, Ultimate Sacrifice. And Ultimate Sacrifice, thebook.com, I think, is the website. But we lay all that stuff out, including the CIA connections. And there's a lot of detail in the new book, Legacy of Secrecy, in particular, about the CIA stuff that's come out since then. Mark Begich is on the line. Mark, the current mayor of Anchorage, running for the Senate, United States Senate in Alaska against Ted Stevens. Mr. Mayor Begich, BEGICH.com. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your time. And we are working aggressively today. Is another vote count day. It's like the Groundhog Day movie over and over and over again.
Yep. Well, we've had, you know, it's you, Jim Martin, and Al Franken. And Jim Martin's been on the show, and we're encouraging people to go to martinforsenate.com and contribute money to his campaign effort, because he's actually running a new campaign, and it's going to be a real challenge. Al Franken is looking for volunteers to help show up and at alfranken.com to help, you know, watch the vote, and they're looking for some lawyers who want to chip in some time. Is there any way that our listeners can help you, Mark Begich, in your effort to unseat Ted Stevens in Alaska?
Absolutely. I think the first thing, I appreciate you mentioning our website, Begich.com, Begich.com. I think the first thing we need to do is make sure all our folks that are out in all the regions monitoring the vote count that's occurring now and will occur Tuesday, we need to make sure we raise the resources, the money, to make sure we can keep them out there. And then depending on if there's going to be a need for a recount or a monitoring of a recount, protecting our votes, that will take some resources. So I would encourage folks, your listeners, if they can, it doesn't matter the size of the donation, every donation makes a difference to help keep our teams out there monitoring. This is an advantage that we have. But when we can't keep our teams in these areas, and Alaska is very unique, as you know. I mean, to go to Fairbanks is 400 miles to the north, and then Nome is another, you know, 400 or 500 miles to the west. And so we have to dispatch people far distances from our main area.
Right, and they can't just hop in the car and be there a half hour later. There's costs associated with that.
Yeah, okay. They can't get in the car and just drive there, that's for sure.
Right. We're talking with Mark Begich. Begich.com is his website. He needs help to support and support to help defeat Ted Stevens here. Mark, a lot of us, you know, we're scratching our heads about all these uncounted ballots, and then Sarah Palin leaves town. She goes down to Florida, and all of a sudden, the ballots are being counted, and you're ahead. I'm guessing this wasn't, you know, conspiracy theories aren't appropriate here. This is just the way it's working. But I think a lot of people across, you know, here in the lower 48 are wondering, why is it taking so long?
Well, here's the first part is, this is the first time, I think, in the history of our voting that we've seen this many votes come in absentee, early voting, or what we call absentee early, almost a third of the votes. And it's because of an effort our field crew did. And really, you know, my vote wasn't counted until Wednesday, matter of fact, because of the way our system
Your own
works.
Personal vote.
That's right, my own vote, yeah. And it was a absentee in person in a different location. But what's really unique about our system is, one, it's a statewide system that's run, but this overwhelmed the state system because they'd never experienced this kind of volume. Yeah. The second part is, literally from the rural areas, you know, if the weather's bad, they can't send the ballots to the main area to be counted. And so that's part of the equation. And we had a significant amount of what we call question ballots or provisional ballots because of so many people wanting to vote in the presidential race and obviously in our statewide Senate race. They just voted wherever they could get to. Well, the problem with that, of course, is we have to verify and go through this long process.
Sure. Mark,
our system just wasn't prepared.
Any chance this is going to flip the House seat as well?
I think that's a tougher. Basically, Don Young has received almost 8,000 more votes than Ted Stevens did. And when you put all the numbers together, I think it's going to be hard to flip that seat. It looks almost impossible.
Okay, but the recount is continuing, and you need help in order to get people out there and make sure that the recount is done right and that it's fair and that it's an honest recount. People can go to Begich, Begich.com, and toss a few bucks your way. And if they're in Alaska, if they're listening to us on KUDO, if they're in Alaska, they can show up and help, I'm assuming. You can use some volunteers.
Absolutely. They can just call our office, and they can get to that at 907-272-6275.
That's great. Mark Begich, Begich.com. Get over there right now and help out. Even if it's a small amount, it doesn't matter at all. It really adds up fast. It really does. It's really important. Mark, good luck.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
And Mr. Mayor, I hope to call you Senator Begich next time we talk. Great talking with you. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
all the freedom that we're fighting for? Is it still our creed from shore to shore? After a soldier fights, should we read him his new rights? There's not that many to read anymore. Where's all the freedom that we're fighting for?
Well, I can tell you one of the men who knows the most about this story, who has lived the hellish side of the Bush administration's corruption and destruction of freedom in the United States, including freedom of personal freedom, the freedom of mobility, is Don Siegelman. Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama, Democratic governor, who was singled out, in my opinion, I don't know if what words he would use to describe it. I'll give him a chance in just a second. But my take on this is he was singled out by Karl Rove and by the Republican machine down in Alabama because he was a Democrat and he was successful and he dared to speak out. And they took this guy down, and it is absolutely wrong. And now new revelations are coming out that are more frightening than anything that we've seen before about the god-awful destruction of freedom and liberty and the rule of law in the United States under Karl Rove, in particular, in the Bush administration. Governor Don Siegelman, donsiegelman.com, by the way, I before E, like they taught you in school, S-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N. Get over to donsiegelman.com. He needs your help on this thing. Don Siegelman, welcome to the show.
Tom, thank you very much. I was shocked by the revelations from Time magazine. It was absolutely incredible that the Department of Justice was involved in a cover-up of this unethical and seemingly criminal activity that was going on within the office of the U.S. Attorney in the Middle District in Alabama.
That would be Laura Canary, the wife of the campaign manager of your Republican opponent.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that out.
What a surprising coincidence!
It goes on. And who's Karl Rove's best friend in Alabama, business partner, and political associate? And you know, it goes on and on. But it is absolutely frightening that we have a Department of Justice whistleblower who points out all of these elements of corruption and unethical behavior on the part of the FBI, the prosecutors, the U.S. attorney, and jurors. It's amazing that if this occurred, then it should have been disclosed at the very outset to the judge and to the defense that a juror had romantic fantasies about having sex with the FBI agent sitting at the U.S. attorney's desk during the trial. And, you know, the fact that they did not disclose this. You know, we don't know what other contacts there may have been. There may have been personal contacts between her and the U.S. attorney, between the FBI. We know that she had contacts with the U.S. Marshal. The Marshal passed messages along, apparently, to the FBI and to the U.S. attorney. And there was no disclosure. And then when the Department of Justice finds out about it, what does our Department of Justice do? They cover it up.
Right. And this is, you know, you and I and your daughter had lunch together in Denver during the DNC, and she made the comment. I asked her, with the prosecution, your dad and everything, what are your thoughts? And her words were, and correct me if I'm wrong, something to the effect of, well, we never in our wildest dreams thought there would be a conviction because, you know, dad was innocent and the evidence was there to prove it. And here we have now a corrupted jury.
Well, but keep in mind what 60 Minutes revealed. Well, you have two things I'd like to point out. One,
yes.
Time magazine's first piece pointed out how I was selectively prosecuted. This was back in April of 2007, I think. Then 60 Minutes in February of this past year came out with a piece that showed that the prosecutors had knowingly extorted false testimony from a felon in order to get a conviction in my case. And now we're faced with more revelations that the Department of Justice, you know, is covering up what has been going on. The other thing, you know, we asked for, through a Freedom of Information Act request, documents relating to this so-called recusal of Lure Canary, which we now know never existed. We didn't think it did, but now we know it didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But those documents were never turned over to us, and even after they were subpoenaed by the House Judiciary Committee, the Department of Justice refused to turn over those documents. We have seen a pattern of cover-up from the Department of Justice on anything that has to do with Karl Rove's involvement in either the firing of the U.S. attorneys or his involvement in political prosecutions such as my case. I hope that your listeners will get on the phone and talk to their congressmen and their senators and say, folks, it is time to blow the lid off this stuff. We want to know the truth. Surely this new administration will get busy and will open the doors to information from DOJ and support the House Judiciary Committee's call for a contempt charge against Karl Rove and bring that guy before the committee where he can either lie under oath or plead the fifth. You know he's not going to tell the truth.
Right. This is, and by the way, people, if you want to call your member of Congress right now, and let me strongly encourage you to call the office of your member of the House of Representatives and both of your senators. That's three phone calls, three simple phone calls you can make that will have a huge impact, because this is, in my opinion, the case that will bust open the criminal activity both at the Justice Department and with regard to Karl Rove that ultimately and eventually will lead, in all probability, all the way into the White House. But even if it just takes out Karl Rove, it takes down Karl Rove legally, it's a great victory. This is the case. And if you go to callcongress.org, there's a list of toll-free phone numbers. If you're not sure who your representative is, just give them your zip code and they'll tell you. If you're not sure who your senators are, tell them what state you live in. They'll connect you. We're talking with Don Siegelman, his website, donsiegelman.com. All the news over there, including the new article in Time Magazine. Governor, is that new article just on Time Magazine's website, or is it going to be in the next issue of the magazine? I confess I don't have the magazine.
Well, it's my understanding that they were planning on, they were trying to hold the story for the magazine, but the news was leaking out so quickly that they decided to go ahead and just put it online. Whether they print it in the magazine or not, I don't know. And it really doesn't matter at this point. I think there are going to be more revelations coming out online through our astute blogging team. I'm excited about the prospects that this is coming unraveled. We understand there may be another whistleblower that's waiting in the wings as well.
We have been on this show, I mean, from the very first time that I read about this, I started talking about it on the air. I had Larissa Alexandrovna on when a couple weeks after the first story was leaking out. She did a really good and thorough investigative report that led, you know, she helped connect me to you, and we got you on. And we have been talking about this on this show for, I don't know how many months or how long it's been, but...
Well, Tom, if you had not been talking, and if Larissa had not been doing her work, you know, I'm not sure how far we would have gotten. But you know, because of the free radio talk shows, and because of the work that's been done through the internet, we've been able to force the main media to pay attention to some of these issues.
Right.
And now they're trying to beat the bloggers to the punch. So that's why I think we had Time Magazine, you know, go with this piece today.
Yeah, and it's a good thing. It's a very, very good thing. And hopefully this will crack the whole thing open, because we've got a guy, Karl Rove, running around who, in my humble opinion, is, you know, a felon who has an enormous amount of blood on his hands, not to mention the, with regard to things like the war in Iraq and lying us into wars and things, not to mention, you know, the false imprisonment of yourself and a number of other people, the corruption of the Justice Department. I mean, the founders have to be rolling over in their graves what these guys have done to this administration.
Well,
just rolling over in their graves.
Yeah, I two comments. One, I think you're right. If we can
if Congress will dig its heels in, if they'll start digging for the truth, and they will discover links, I believe, to Karl Rove and the war in Iraq. They'll discover links to Karl Rove and stolen elections or attempted theft of elections. I think they will find Karl Rove with his fingerprints all over. Well, they've already got him all over the firing of the U.S. attorneys and my case. But it is so important that Congress continue this effort. And, again, I encourage your listeners to pick up the phone and call their member of Congress.
Go to callcongress.org and pick up one of those toll-free numbers. You can make the call. It won't cost you a penny. It gets you right to the switchboard for the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. And ask to talk to your whether they're not in or not, you can leave a message with the office. Please call on Congress to investigate the Siegelman case and to hold Karl Rove in contempt of Congress for refusing to testify. Any other words that they should say in that call, Governor Siegelman?
No, that's actually perfect. To continue the investigation of the Siegelman case and to hold Karl Rove in contempt.
Yeah, there we go. And you can read all the details at donsiegelman.com, I before E, Don, SIEGELMAN.com, or .org. Either one will get you there. Governor Don Siegelman, thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, sir. Thanks for helping us continue the fight.
I will always be there with you, sir, and you'll be back on this show again. Good luck.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Indeed. Thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to my producers, Sean Taylor, to Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, Stephanie Whiteman, and Marcus Hillman at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Yeah, well, you never know. Some strange stuff going on out there. Number one, Mexico City giving out free Viagra to men 70 years and older. Seriously, starting December 1st, if you're over 70, you can get up to two pills a day. Mayor Mark Marcello Ebrard says the city is implementing the plan because this has a lot to do with the quality of life and our happiness. I wonder if he's over 70. And the other one, this Cobb County Waste Facility employees discovered three dead pigeons hanging over fishing wire from the weekend. One of the pigeons was hanging from a wire that resembled a noose, county spokesman Robert Quigley said. I just want to point out, these could not have been pigeons because pigeons are robots from the planet Xenu sent here to spy on us from the mother ship, as we all know. That's why nobody ever sees dead pigeons. Nobody ever sees baby pigeons. Every 6 months, the mothership comes down and grabs all the old pigeons and drops a whole new load, and they unwind all those tape recorders. That's why whenever there's a big event going on, whether it's world leaders, government leaders, corporate leaders, or even mafia leaders, what do you see? Lots of pigeons. So this couldn't have been real pigeons. It had to be, maybe baby chickens or doves painted up like pigeons. So just to bring you up to date on the events of the day. And speaking of the events of the day, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, is on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Well, I'm totally down with that because I just walked along the front of the White House. There were no dead pigeons there at all.
No, nobody ever.
Nothing, and we've got 20 world leaders coming there later today.
That's right. Were there live pigeons there?
Live pigeons flying around.
Yeah, absolutely. See, nobody has ever seen a dead pigeon or a baby pigeon. And every now and then somebody will send me an email saying, oh, no, I saw a dead pigeon back in 1947. And I go, no, it wasn't really a pigeon. It was a dove that the robots painted to look like a pigeon.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you know.
Wow.
Yeah. So what's going on in the world, Victoria?
Well, you just topped anything I could have talked about. Well, we've got the leaders of 20 nations coming to meet with President Bush at the White House tonight for dinner at the beginning of the G20 summit. President Bush fired a shot across the bow yesterday in a speech he gave in New York by saying that there shouldn't be more regulation, that the free market should be allowed basically to survive.
Yes, it's worked so well these last 26 years, 28 years.
Well, that's his argument, although, of course, he was in favor of the $700 billion bailout.
Yeah, which is sort of not exactly a free market, is it?
No, it's not exactly a free market.
But it does go to rich bankers. He doesn't want to. He's willing to give $700 billion to rich bankers, but he doesn't want to give $25 billion to the car companies to save 20 million union jobs.
It's a very interesting paradox. It really is.
I would say it goes beyond paradox, but I have a little more salty words to describe it. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So and I understand that the Obama campaign is sending Madeleine Albright, and there was a Republican. I'm forgetting his name.
Representative Jim Leach is the emissary from the Obama campaign. We understand that several of the world leaders are quite keen to meet with them. It's going to be a strange situation whereby you've got the Bush administration there. Obama has said there's only one president at a time. That's why he's not going. And so, of course, the Bush administration is basically running this thing, along with Nicolas Sarkozy of France, to a certain extent. But, of course, you've got these world leaders wanting to meet with the upcoming administration because they will be implementing any decisions that are made, if there are any decisions made.
Right, right. What's your sense, or what's the buzz around Washington, D.C., about what might actually come out of this? I know that early on people were talking about this is the new Bretton Woods, and, of course, Bretton Woods was the conference a year and a half before World War II ended, in anticipation of the end of the war, at which basically the U.S. dollar became the peg currency for the world. An international banking system was set up, or a bank of last resort system with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. I mean, these were huge, sweeping measures, and that defined monetary and intergovernmental policy for two, three generations. It seems to me like what's in all probability going to come out of this is just a whole lot of rhetoric and not much else, largely as a result of obstructionism by the United States.
It seems as though there will be some rhetoric coming out of this. This is the first one. They don't anticipate this to be the only one. But one thing that is quite likely to come out of it, if not this one, then maybe the next one, but quite possibly this one, is some kind of overhaul of the IMF and the World Bank. There is a feeling in the rest of the world, those who aren't well represented, that the Europeans are vastly overrepresented in the IMF. And that is pretty much generally accepted.
It's true. And that the IMF and the World Bank have been used historically to promote the interests of large transnational corporations that do things like build dams and electric turbines and power plants, and also to assert, to inflict on countries, basically the Milton Friedman School of Economics, you know, shock therapy, like happened in Chile with their social security system. We'll give you a loan if you'll privatize social security. And it was a disaster for Chile, and this is standard operating procedure for the World Bank.
So the feeling is that rather than getting rid of the World Bank or the IMF and then replacing them with something else completely, that they would like to see overhauls of those organizations. That is likely to happen.
Reinvent them as somewhat less neoliberal and more perhaps real liberal, using the American use of the term, not the British use of the term.
Yes.
That would be probably a very good outcome. Victoria Jones, thanks for the report today.
Thank you.
And be careful what you say around pigeons. Coming up next week, I'm going to be on the Air America Listener Cruise next week while I'm gone. Lee Rayburn of Madison, Wisconsin's The Mike 92.1 and Jay Marvin of Denver's AM 760 KKZN will be sitting in the chair with me. I'll be back in a week with more great guests and provocative talk radio for you. Have a great time. Don't forget, my friends, activism and democracy begin with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend and a great week.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.